RD3 in the house, the high octane human.
But somebody's been on my LinkedIn.
You know, when you have a name like High Octane Human, you know what? It's a superhero name.
It's like a summary. You need to like a, you need something snappy. You need something with a hyphen in it. High Octane Human seemed like it fit.
Welcome to Building Bellingham. This is your host, Leo Cohen. And today I'm incredibly excited to sit down with Ray Deck III, founding director of Skookum Kids, the Bellingham Chamber of Commerce's CEO of the year. Throughout our conversation, Ray shares insights into what makes him a strong leader of Skookum Kids, taking natural talent and purposefully developing leadership as a skill, planning, preparing, and surrounding yourself with high-caliber team members who are humble, hungry, and smart. Skookum Kids is built around a single big idea. It's an organization whose mission statement says it all. If we take great care of people, the mission will take care of itself. So we work really hard to make this a delightful place to volunteer and to be a foster parent. We believe in health for all, meaning that no person should ever have to sacrifice their own health to serve kids. That's not to say we don't work hard, because believe me, we do, but that healthy, happy, well-supported people get more done. So Ray Deck III, we have you here. You are the founding director and CEO of Skookum Kids, and we're going to dive a little bit more into what this means, because this has been a journey for you. Tell me a little bit about Skookum Kids. What is it?
Yeah,
how did you create it? What does it stand for?
So Skookum Kids is a foster care charity. One of the things that was a unique challenge for social workers and foster parents in Whatcom County, when kids came into foster care, there was no good plan for where they go. So, you know, the phrase we use sometimes is they're coming in hot, right? Mm-hmm. So they're coming from somewhere unsafe. DCYF, that's the agency of state government that handles foster care, they're completely unprepared. They are flat-footed. They didn't know anything about this child. And it's, 7 p.m. on a Friday night, and we need a foster home now. Like, we need somewhere to put them right now. And every community has this problem, right? Kids come into foster care often, middle of the night, weekends, holidays, very inconvenient times to try to put them in a foster home. And they often come into foster care with very little information known about them. You know, believe it or not, kids lie to social workers. So it's really common that a child will be in foster care for a week, and a week later, you know, after a week of being in foster care, it's like, oh, all these things we thought we knew about the child, actually, none of that's true. All this other stuff is true. So this creates a condition where we call it the 72-hour problem, which means the challenges of caring for the child in the first 72 hours are very different than, you know, caring for the child every day after that.
So once they're settled in the home versus like that intake period where it's like, where do they go?
Intake, is often a word that's used to describe it. So that's what we got started doing. It was like, let's solve the 72-hour problem. Let's give children a soft landing in foster care. So we do that. And then also the other thing we do, which I can explain why we got into it, is we help families who want to become foster parents. We train them, we license them, and then we support them.
It's amazing. But this is not just the only thing that defines you, because the point of having you here is we want to know more about the other dimensions of who you are, the dimensions of what's actually inside that beard. Is it birds? Is
anxiety.
It anxiety? Yeah. Anxiety. So tell me a little bit more about yourself.
Sure.
Who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here?
Yeah, grew up on the East Coast. So like I say, my family's West Virginians, back six generations. My immediate family, my two brothers, my parents and I are the first decks since coming from the old country to leave West Virginia. It was a big family scandal when we moved to North Carolina. But I think of North Carolina as home. That's where I, you know, was a teenager, and we moved there when I was 12. And then went to college in New York, college and grad school, and then I got a job in Bellingham. So I moved to Bellingham for work. Everybody moves to Bellingham for college and then moves away to get a real job. I moved to Bellingham because I got a real job here. And when I moved here, I had never been west of my brother's house in Kansas.
Wow.
And he was the person I knew who lived furthest west. I knew a bunch of people east, you know, UK, Africa, but
I
didn't
pioneer.
Know. Yeah, I didn't know anybody west. So, you know, driving my U-Haul truck when I left his house on my cross-country road trip.
You didn't know if you were going to fall off the earth.
I was going to find out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got a job in Bellingham and thought, why not? Let's give it a shot. I was single, unattached, just thought, hey, why not? You know, while you're young, let's go. And really fell in love with Bellingham and met my wife here. And we got set up and dated for a while. And when we started getting serious, we had a conversation that was like, okay, where do we want to raise a family? Where do we want to put down roots? And, you know, I could, you know, move south, the big city. We could move back east. What do we want to do? She's an Army kid. She lived everywhere. We both felt really a deep connection to this community and wanted to, you know, make a go of it here. And when we decided that, that was a really important formative moment for me. Oh, Bellingham's home. Oh, okay. And so suddenly I cared about stuff I'd never had an interest in before. Like
what?
Local politics, community health. I started going to like neighborhood association meetings and crap like that I never cared about before. And at a neighborhood association meeting about a completely unrelated subject, I just happened to sit at the same table with a woman who'd worked in foster care her whole career, 30-plus year career in foster care. And I just sat down next to her. Hi, who are you? What do you do? And she told me she worked in child welfare. And I said, interesting. What's that mean? I think I had a get to know you question at the time that I was using that. I asked her, what does Bellingham need? And she had a bullet list for me, right?
Wow.
She like listed off stuff, and not accidentally, that's the list of stuff that Skookum Kids does today.
It all started there.
That's where it started.
I want to jump back to your childhood, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So you got me really interested when you said it was a big deal when you moved from Virginia to North Carolina.
West Virginia, yeah.
Why? Why was that a big deal? Is it a Southern thing? Is it a cultural thing down in the South? Why was that a big deal to move?
It's strong sense of place.
Yeah.
You know, strong sense of place. The my dad has four older sisters, and my granddad has 12 siblings. He's the oldest. He is really more a father to them than a brother. We are West Virginians. My people are from West Virginia. Very, very strong, deeply rooted sense of place. And so to pick up and move somewhere else and to be not a West Virginian, to be something different.
What does that mean to be a West Virginian? What do you think defines that culture?
I think a lot of it is a self-reliance, and independence, and yet so strong independence and a strong sense of family. Like, you know, we are who we are because we're all here.
Yeah,
you know?
I understand that.
And so to pick up and move three states away was pretty dramatic.
And then you went from the South to New York.
Yeah.
Tell me about that transition. What is that like for you?
Yeah. So when I was, I think it was, I don't know, 13 or so, I went to summer camp for a week.
What was the summer camp called?
Word of Life.
Word of Life.
Which is kind of, in Bellingham, that's a loaded name.
Right.
Because there was a Word of Life church in Linden for a while, but completely unaffiliated. It's like not at all related. It just happens to have the same name. The place I went, it's called Word of Life, and it was a church camp, you know. And I went there for a week, loved it. I'm a camp person. I kind of became a camps person. you know, I was a camper every year until I was old enough to be on staff. And then I was on staff all summer, every year until I graduated from high school. And my parents were very big on, you know, kids should grow up and leave the nest. You should go, you know. Yeah. And so I turned 18, moved out, and didn't come back, you know. And so I got my first job out of high school, really, was at camp. So
was it a camp director by chance?
You know, I was, the official title was staff coordinator. So it was kind of like HR. So I hired and managed about 120 or so high school and college kids.
And you were 19?
I was.
Yeah. You were 19 and you were managing?
Yeah.
100 and how many people?
120, yeah. Hmm. That's... I've been somebody's boss since I was 15. I was 15 and a half, and the assistant manager at the grocery store I worked at rage quit. And the manager said, Ray, you know what's going on. You're in charge. And I've been somebody's boss since then.
So you've been in this position where you've kind of naturally solidified yourself in leadership positions. What has that meant to be from a early age on to really step into those leadership roles?
Leadership is equal parts a skill and a talent. I think there are people who are just naturally inclined to go first, to set the tone. And also, it's a learned behavior. There are plenty of people who have that talent who never figure out how to use that, you know, for good.
'Cause it takes refining.
Yeah, it does. And I've always had a little bit of the, I mean, you might call it a pluck would be the, you know, the nice way to say it. Ignorance of the consequences would be another way to say it. But I've always, I'm a jump and figure out where we're going to land later kind of person.
Cheers to that.
And hey, and that often means I'm going first. Mm-hmm. And you know, it took some mentor, some, you know, people that I respected saying, hey, you've got something there. You know, if you worked on it a little, it could be special.
Wow. So, okay. So you made the transition from camp that you were a hiring director at.
Yeah. So I moved from Raleigh, which was the big city, mm-hmm. right? Which is where I went to high school and I moved from there to camp, and I was the, you know, staff coordinator, right, at camp. And I would do that during the summers. And during the off season, I was the road guy. So I would travel around and I'd visit, you know, high schools, youth groups, conferences, all kinds of stuff, and say, hey, you should come to camp in the summer, right? So I did a lot of traveling around the Northeast and the Midwest. And
so how long did you do this for?
8 years. Yeah, I was doing that for 8 years.
It's okay. Okay, so you do this for 8 years, and at that point where you decided you wanted to move to Bellingham, tell me about this point where you've been there for 8 years, and was it kind of a moment that just dawned on you, made kind of a knee-jerk decision, or was this something you were planning over the course of that 8 years?
You know, I sort of capped out mm-hmm. at the organization that I was at. They had a deeply flawed organizational structure at the time.
Tell me more about that.
You could, at the time, you could be like entry level, right? Like, you know, hourly, on food stamps, maybe health insurance, you know? Mm-hmm. Or you could be a vice president with an expense account and a company car with nothing in between. So if you did the entry level thing for 30 years, they'd make you a vice president. All it took was staying power, yeah. right? You had to prove that you were loyal by waiting in line. And I wasn't about that. And I was single, didn't want to be single, didn't feel great about, like, even if I, like, found the right girl here, I couldn't, like, feed her, you know? So I needed to do something different. And so I started poking around. And I was, you know, it was a camp and conference center and a few other things. And we had this conference that we did at the conference center that was it was for pastors. It was every year in the fall, and we added this component that a lot of people were, you know, really excited about. That was it was an extra couple day, like upgrade thing you could do. That was like training in this really fancy Bible software tool, right?
I know where you're leading with this.
And we had, you know, worked out for this, the company who made this software to come in and do this training. And it was like really special on the East Coast to have this, you know, fancy West Coast software company come out and teach you how to use this really exotic tool. So I had built a little bit of a relationship with this software company. And sure enough, they're based in Bellingham. FaithLife. Great company. Bob, great friend. Wonderful place to work. I just absolutely loved my time there.
What was the moment that clicked where you said, I need to move?
I read Bob's book. So his first book, my dad got it for me when I was in college. And I don't you know what his book's called?
I don't. Tell me.
His first book is called Fire Someone Today. Every chapter is like a rant that he will go on, you know, every once in a while. And one of them, the like titular chapter, is the point he makes, which is, it sounds scarier. The title sounds scarier than it actually is. But the point he makes is that if somebody doesn't fit, you are doing them a favor by letting them move on and find something that they do fit in, right? So, you know, I read Bob's first book, Fire Someone Today, and thought, that's a guy I should work for.
you just clicked with the radical honesty.
Yeah, I did.
Which is interesting because you recommended a book called Radical Candor to me, which I read, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Which leads to radical honesty, which leads back to that conversation about you're doing someone a favor by being brutally honest with them about what's working, what's not, right? But also being very perceptive of like how you present it to them, right?
Which is very contrary to Pacific Northwest. Like Pacific Northwest has a particular style of being indirect.
And how would you fire someone in the Pacific Northwest?
So I was thinking, this has been really great, but I wonder if something would be more great.
For you.
Yeah, for you. For you. I wonder if there's something more great for you.
Yeah, and less bad for us. So that's how you fire someone in the Northwest. That's well done.
Maybe. Yeah. You had a maybe.
There's no right way of
always
doing
a
this.
Weasel word at the end. Maybe.
Potentially.
I was thinking.
Possibly.
I felt.
You go first though. So you read this book. What was one of those things that stuck out to you in this book about Bob and what made it feel like a good connection for you to go work for this person across country in a place, potentially, maybe, in the Northwest?
You know, the thing I appreciate the most about Bob, which really it came through in that book, I think it comes through in his second book, and anybody who interacts with him would, I think, pick up on this, is he doesn't care about the politics. He doesn't care about that. Like, he thinks what he thinks, and he's going to tell you what he thinks. He's going to make his case, and he's going to stand by it. It's his candor. It's his directness that I appreciate, which I appreciate. It is also very uncomfortable because he really wants, you know, and he wants this from the people who work for him too, he wants somebody to spar with him. If he's wrong, he wants you to prove it.
Yeah.
You know? And he believes what he believes, and he thinks what he thinks, and if he thought he was wrong or if he had any uncertainty about it, he would think something different.
Yeah.
And he has he does the work to inform his opinions, you know? Mm-hmm. So when he expresses an opinion, it's not like it's just his gut or that's what he's done the work to decide whether that's a good thing to think or not. And that's really, you know, it's an intellectual rigor that's really refreshing. I think he desires precision more than he wants to be right. Like, he doesn't want to win the argument. He wants to figure out what is correct.
He's a mathematical
correct
guy,
is different
sure.
than right.
For
you
sure.
know, and he wants precision over, vindication.
Yeah, understood.
And that's you know.
So you connected with that?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Because growing through this leadership stage, I mean, you're still obviously a leader, but growing up and evolving as a leader, you immediately saw this. You saw the man behind the software that you were using. You saw this book that came forth that some people might be offended by the title. But realistically, if you think about who he is and his intentions, you connected with that. You connected with that. And so then what did that conversation evolve into? How did you end up in Bellingham? How did you end up working at FaithLife?
You know, it was, so it started with, I need to be somewhere other than where I am right now. I think most of the time, at least in my life, the exit comes before the, like, what do I do next? It's not, I think it's really fashionable in our world to say, everything was going great and I loved it and I was happy, but this thing came along that was just irresistible.
Right.
I've never had that experience. The exit has always, like, I've always become aware that an exit is necessary.
Prior to your next move.
Right.
Yeah.
Before figuring out, okay, well, how do I do that? How do I figure out what I, and it started with anything but here. I got to figure out anything but here. And then when you make that decision, then it's, okay, well, if not here, then where?
Right.
And then you make a list. And for me, it usually starts with, well, who do I want to work for? Who do I respect? What do I want to go do? What tools do I use? I tend to work in software. You know, before Skookum, I worked in software. And so it was, what tools do I use? That I, you know, think other people would make other people's lives better. And, let me see if there's something at those places if there's a slot in the team that makes the thing that I use, or if there's an opportunity to work for the person I respect, or something like that. It's more that, it's less like browsing openings on Indeed or something, you know?
Yeah. Understood.
Yeah.
So what was your role? And what was that?
Copywriter.
Copywriter.
Yeah.
What does that mean to be a copywriter?
I wrote blog content. Mm-hmm. I occasionally wrote product descriptions. I occasionally wrote email. But, you know, this is the... See, I'm sure you've heard the, when somebody offers you a seat on a rocket ship, you don't quibble over which one.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was that. It was like, I don't care what you want me to do. I want to be here. This is where I want to be. I wasn't a copywriter for very long,
yeah.
But that's what I got hired to do.
How long did you do that role for?
Maybe 18 months or so.
18 months.
Yeah.
So what was your moment of exit for that role? Like, what was that like for you?
It was gradual. It wasn't a single moment. It was, you know, Faith Life is a place, and I always tend to work at places where experimentation is encouraged,
mm-hmm.
and where, you know, nobody's going to slap your hand for working outside your role, for dabbling, and for, you know. And I just got this knack for, waking up dead leads. You know, like dead, cold, icy, frozen, you know, like no hope leads, like everybody else was ignoring. And I figured out how to wake them up. And that.
What do you mean?
You know, it's like we had a name, an email address, a phone number, and nothing else, and hadn't heard from them in years.
And you did some sleuthing.
And we figured out how to turn them into a customer. And, they'd bought one thing. They'd spent 99 cents on our platform 6 years ago, and we hadn't heard from them since, right? Dead cold lead. And how do you turn that person into someone who spends $1,000 or more every year for the, you know, 10, 15 years, the rest of the decade?
That's,
you know,
a huge, huge, huge skill.
Huge, which is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can pull it off, you will be a legend. But there's a reason nobody's jumping at it.
Right.
Right? Because it's not easy to put points on that scoreboard. So I had I've always had a day job and a side hustle. So at Faith Life for a while, the day job was copywriter, blog mm-hmm. content. And the side hustle became, let me figure out how to crack this. We got, you know, 10,000, 25,000, however many, you know, leads that fit into this category of dead cold, and what can we do with them? What's the smartest way to handle them? And then it turned into, Ray's got a plan. It actually works pretty good. Let's build a team around it, and Ray should lead it. So then I became a team lead.
So you ended up as a leader again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting. So your side hustle was to revive, and for our listeners in the world of sales and business, lead meaning somebody had inquired about or purchased one time or whatever it may be. In the real estate world, it's somebody that's, you know, signed up on a website with partially false information that, you know, says
Chester Moist Muffins.
Yeah, Chester Moist Muffins. Right. Go do know you know what to yourself, like, you know,
yeah.
That's what it says is their name. Their number is 1234567. You know,
yeah,
like, it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
So this is somebody that has had interest in the product or buying a house or buying the software.
But that was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
And they don't really want anybody to call them.
Yeah. They don't want anybody calling them.
They don't think.
But they kind of do.
Kinda.
But not quite. So you started doing this. They built the team around you.
Yeah.
And obviously someone like Bob, that's the business owner, wants those leads to be converted.
Sure.
Those are leads that they're not really marketing to, right? They're just sitting there.
Right.
So what was that team like? What was the structure like? How did you grow that team?
Yeah.
How long did it take?
You know, honestly, we were an island of misfit toys for a while. It was people who didn't fit other places. You know, it became projects that didn't fit other places. It was not like, oh, this is the specific kind of work that this team does. It was more like, this team can figure out how to do stuff that nobody else wants to figure out. And so we called ourselves experimental projects.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did at first was ideas or promotions or campaigns or whatever that the rest of the marketing department could never like get around to. But everybody thought it had just enough value to leave it on the list, like mm-hmm. maybe someday. So we did all the someday maybe stuff.
It's for high octane humans.
You got it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we caught Bob's attention, and then I went to work for him instead of in the marketing department. We went to work for Bob. So our structure was cross-functional. So it was a developer, a designer, a project manager, and me. So really small team, nimble, and we worked on the wildest, craziest moonshot ideas. A lot of it was, you know, stuff Bob dreamed up that he thought it had potential, but he wanted somebody to just try it out and find out, you know, is this really a thing? Some of it was the someday maybe list, you mm-hmm. know, it's like maybe someday we'll build a, you know, whatever.
A flux capacitor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes it, you know, there's several things we worked on that now today there are whole lines of business
mm-hmm.
at Faith Life. So we would, you know, we would carry an idea or a project all the way to launch. And if it had legs, we mm-hmm. would say, you know, if it's like worth carrying on, then we'd hand it to somebody else in the company and they'd run with it. And if it didn't, then we'd kill it and move on.
Wow. And how long were you at Faith Life for?
Three-ish mm-hmm. years, something like that. Yeah.
So, again, your theme is that you get to a point, you're back into a leadership position, and then you hit a point where something changed. You started thinking about your exit, right? And this may have been a positive exit or this may have been a negative exit, and we don't need to get into the details of that, but what was the buildup like in this company where you're basically taking all these ideas and you're tinkering around and you're making these bigger ideas happen? And then passing them off, what was that process like for you?
This is a fun story. So I was at somewhere along the line there. Skookum became my side thing. So the story about I met the social worker and I you know learned about the need for what Skookum Kids does today. So that conversation. So I talked to her that night at the neighborhood association meeting. We talked and she had this bullet list of things she thought Bellingham needed, and I was like, cool, great. Sounds like you got a great plan. Do you need a website? I'll build a website for you if you want. She was like, yeah, great. And so we agreed to meet at the Woods Coffee in the Flatiron. So we mm-hmm. met there, and she brought some friends, and I brought some friends. And all I volunteered to do was build the website, right? And we met, and we didn't get very far in the first meeting. We kind of get to know you. It was like, we'll meet next week. And so the next week we met and didn't get very far that time. Okay, we'll meet next week. We met in that Woods Coffee every Friday afternoon for 6 months and made plans and talked and got to know each other and built trust. And, you know, and then parallel to that, Keely and I got engaged and got married. And so we...
at this point, you could feed your family.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah, that was important. Yeah, you felt good about it.
And we got engaged, and I met with this group every Friday afternoon for 6 months. And then Keely and I got married. We went on our honeymoon and came back. And I tell people that I wrote the business plan for Skookum on my honeymoon, which is mostly
That's not very
true.
Romantic.
She got strep.
Oh.
So she was laid up for 2 days, a day and a half or so. And so I sat on the balcony and finished the business plan. And then I came back and we started Skookum. And I never planned to leave Faith Life. Honestly, I was thrilled to work there. I loved the team. I loved the work we were doing. It was different every day. It was interesting. I was just loving it. Never planned to leave. I thought this Skookum thing, I will like help it get started. And then I'll hand it to somebody who knows what they're doing. Maybe I'll be on the board and I'll like run a fundraising event, you know, once a year, something. Like I'll like, Lori clearly knows what she wants. That's the social worker's name. Lori clearly knows what this should be. She's got a plan. She knows way more about this. I don't know anything about foster care. She knows way more about this stuff than me. I'll like get it going, like create some momentum and then hand it to her. And then I got laid off.
Wow.
Yep. Yep. Early 2015, Faith Life laid off 20% of the workforce. And if you're going to lay off 20%, you're definitely going to lay off the experimental projects team. So, I was out on the street. And parallel to that, at Skookum, I had just initiated the conversation. Like literally the night before, I had sent an email that said, I think it's probably about time we hire a director. Here's what I think we could pay them. Here's what I think their job should be. You know, it's like we've had the good luck in fundraising so far. I think it's time for employee number two. We already had one, like halftime, you know, program person. It's like, I think we need a fundraiser. And here's what I think they should do. And here's what I think we could pay them. And then the next morning I went in and.
You got hired?
Right.
So, yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about Skookum Kids.
Sure.
And where it's at now. You guys are. Is it 60 households right now?
Yep. 60 families within a 1 hour drive of Bellingham that we've licensed.
And for our listeners, can we kind of describe 60 households to me is a large number, yep. But I don't know, what is that compared to?
That is half of the total number of foster parents in Whatcom County.
And this is since 2013?
Yep, right. Well, we've only been licensing foster homes since early 2017.
So you've been doing this for right around 2.5 years?
Yep. Right.
And you're at half.
Yep.
It's amazing.
It's been a wild ride. We all have nosebleeds from the acceleration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Tell me a little bit more about, I want to hear more about your day-to-day operations.
Sure.
So you've created the 72-hour solution.
Yeah.
You've created this amazing system for educating is there a licensing process to become a foster parent?
Yeah.
So you've created this whole program to make the process a lot easier for the parents, for the kids. You're the connector, you're the glue. And we have this business group that we're in together. It's business, life, it's all of the above. Yeah. And it's, I'm really grateful for that group. And we talk a lot about our day-to-day operations. And one of the things that I want to talk a little bit about is your productive day versus your unproductive day. What does that look like in Ray Deck's world?
You know, I think about it as a front foot, back foot. That's a little bit soccer terminology. So front foot is when I decide what I'm going to go do, and then I go do that thing. And back foot is when I'm reacting. All day I feel like I'm reacting to what's happening around me. Stuff coming in the office, and you know, I'm getting emails and pings and notifications and calls, and I'm just reacting. I'm not like going out and making things happen. I am just sort of trying to keep up, right? I'm a 7 to 6 guy, so 7A to 6P. I try to be 7 to 6 4 days a week, but anymore it turns into 7 to 6 Monday to Friday. I do my best to batch my work. So Mondays are maintenance day. So Mondays are update the database, notes, email, finish, follow up, errands, run around. It's very manic, Mondays are manic.
Yeah, it's a bottleneck on Monday typically.
You know, kind of buzzing, stuff that's been waiting, I've been putting off. It's a lot of, you know, like run around town. Tuesdays are check-in days. So it's back-to-back meetings with staff, direct reports and things. So that's a lot of feelings. It's a lot of people work. It's a lot of, like, people management work. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of, answering questions, making decisions, communication. I'm most tired on Tuesdays. Wednesday is plug in, close the door, create things. Mm-hmm. So it's
that, I love those days.
I'm the marketing guy at Skookum. I'm you know, it's my background. So marketing, I'm the content creator generally. So I usually make a video every Wednesday.
I get all your videos.
Hey, thanks. Yep. And you know, it's load up the buffer queue. It's that kind of stuff. Email. It's plug in, create. Thursdays are external meeting days. Which is tends to be, you know, meetings with supporters, meetings with potential foster parents. I do a lot of speaking on Thursdays, just kind of how it works out. I wind up, you know, doing a lot of public speaking and, you know, lots of coffee meetings, beer meetings, you know. And then Friday is loose ends day. So it's whichever day didn't go well, I get a second try on Friday.
I love that.
Yeah.
So back to public speaking. I mean, I've heard you speak. In fact, we went to your fundraising dinner, which was at Bellingham Technical College.
Yeah, it was fun.
One of the things that I had noticed about you when you were you're an amazing storyteller. Mm. You've got this amazing pace. Mm. It's very patient. Your words are weighted. You just have a very solid way of presenting your story and telling stories. And there's a huge story to what you do. One of the things that I'm really interested in, coming from a background for you of a little bit of theater and debate, there's still this space before a keynote speech. What do you do in that space before?
You know what? The few moments before I go on stage and speak are a lot less important than what happens weeks before. If I'm practiced, then it doesn't matter what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm instant. You know, like, pull a string, let me go. You know, to me, it's about practice. I'm always scripted. I always transcript every time. I practice in front of the mirror repeatedly. If I speak in public, I'm not ad-libbing. I'm not improvising. I'm not off the cuff. I actually really hate that. I am scripted. The jokes are scripted, planned in advance. You know, it's planning to me. It's about what happens a month before, 2 weeks before, a week before, and then the like actual moment before really is irrelevant. So long as I hear my cue and hit my mark. If I've practiced, like, who cares?
It's quite literally a deep breath and then a step into the portal, right?
So that particular event you're talking about, the thing nobody knew is that my script got all messed up.
How did it get messed up?
I put it on the podium. So I always have two copies, and I had a copy that I put on the podium in advance. And I thought, okay, this will be here, and I'll just walk up and here it'll be, and I'll just, like, flip through it and you know. And I got up there, and it was like every other page, my script and the speaker before me, and then my script and the speaker before me. Somehow it got like mixed up. I had another one in my pocket. Just pull one out of my pocket. And, okay, well, I guess we're using this one.
So for people out there that are wanting to be the best public speaker they can, what I'm hearing from you is just, it's just all about preparation. It's all about preparation. It's like, it's not about the fact that the first one lights on fire. It's the fact that there's a second one.
Yeah. There's no, so it's about preparation and it's about repetitions. You're gonna lay an egg sometime. Like, it's just flat gonna happen.
Have you ever laid an egg?
Oh, 100%. Ugh.
Tell me about it. What was the biggest egg that you've ever laid?
When I was in high school, I spoke in the, like, a general assembly, like, chapel thing, right? And I remember hubris is what did it. I had just won a speech competition, but I had given that speech to the school before we went to this competition. And then I went and, you know, I had done all the practice, right? Mm-hmm. And then I went and gave the speech, won, came back, and they're like, it was like a victory lap kind of thing. The principal was like, you won the thing, you should do the, and I think he thought I was going to do the same thing again. But I thought, these people have already heard that. I'm going to do something different. And I didn't prep. I just flat didn't prep. I didn't have it. I didn't transcript. I didn't prep. I didn't practice in front of the mirror. I just thought, I'm a natural. I'm great at this. It's when you assume that it's under control and you don't need the prep, that disaster. And it's funny. I remember snippets of that speech, and I remember like points I started and never finished, like jokes that I set up and never, like the punchline, I just never delivered the punchline. And my brother actually had the comment afterwards. This is my brother. You know, he's 15 months younger than me, one grade behind me. You know, we were like into all the same stuff, very much rivals in school. Pretty close now, but he, after I got down, he looked at me and said, you've done better.
So, okay. So this is your number one, public speaking.
Yeah.
You do it a lot. Mm-hmm. You're great at it. People management. What's your style? What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? How do you do it?
I'm pretty hands-off, honestly, as a people manager. Facilitative is how I describe my style. People want to do a good job. They want to build something good. They want to make something good. They want to build something that matters. There are a lot of bosses in the world who imagine that, you know, without their direct involvement, the work isn't going to happen. And that leads to a very overbearing, like directive presence in the office. And I tend to not be like that. I tend to, you know, assume people want to be good. They want to do good work. And every once in a while, that's not true. But the times when that's not true is kind of like a blinking neon light and you can see it.
So you have a genuine perception of humans as wanting to do good and be good.
Yeah, yeah. Assume the best. I think you start from that place, assume the best. And every once in a while, you know, a boss needs to step in and just a little nudge and kind of steer and redirect. But most of the time, let people run. Like most of being a boss is getting out of the way. Like a lot of times it's not like the boss has special knowledge and, you know, special experience. And if the employee just knew what the boss knew, then they would be doing different things. A lot of times it's, you know, you get so close to the work and so you're so invested in it that you can't see it objectively anymore. And anybody, like literally anyone, could come in and see the thing. Like,
you just happen to be the vessel.
I just happen to be the one who's sitting there, right? Like, hey, wait a minute. Did you notice, right? Which that requires a humility. Like, the worst bosses think that they have some like special gift or some special skill that no one else is capable of replicating, and that no, you need to check with me first because I'm like,
I'm the one
special.
Person.
I'm gifted, yeah. Right? I'm the one, right? And like, I hate working for people who are like that, and I hate being that guy. Every once in a while, I think it's human nature to slip into that. That's hubris, right? And the truth is a little more that like hard things are hard for everybody, and you know, the person who's been staring at this like puzzle and working it and grinding, they're just so close to it that their vision's distorted and fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, the best bosses appear with fresh eyes.
So for you, for someone that's very skilled, I there's a number of things that we've talked about that I know that you're very skilled at. For somebody like you that is also very confident, how do you deal with failure? How do you deal with something not going the way that you thought it would go? How do you deal with moments like that?
The psychological challenge for me is to focus on the parts of my work product that I can control and not the results. We are a results-oriented people, a results-oriented culture, where we tend to glorify, we interview on podcasts, the people have gotten good results. You probably wouldn't interview me if Skookum had, like, you know, run for 6 months and then closed. If I had done everything right and we hadn't gotten lucky, that might have been what had happened. Like, we had a lot of really good fortune. And if not for the good luck, like if we didn't get the cards, it doesn't matter how good we play our pocket pair. And I think it requires a humility, and maybe a broadness of perspective to say, you know, the results, I'm only at max half responsible for these results. And when things don't go your way, then the work is, did they not go my way because I did something wrong and I need to learn, I need to grow and get better? Or did they not go my way because I did everything right and I didn't get the breaks? I had bad luck. And what you do next, like the way you answer that question determines what you do next.
So you put it through that filter every time. And what is that for you? What has been the biggest failure in your career so far at Skookum Kids? Because we all, in order to get to the level that you are and that you will be and your organization will continue to grow to, you have to have big failures. Tell me about those.
Yeah, 3 years ago, we managed to secure some multi-year funding to scale our foster care operation. So foster parent training, licensing, support. And, you know, it was a pretty big award, a lot of money, mid six figures. The first half came free and clear. And then the second half came in two tranches, chunks at 12 and 24 month milestones based on certain growth targets. So the funding was so that we could grow. It was to create growth in the nonprofit world that's called capacity building. And, you know, it was like, okay, here's half. And if this has the result you think it's going to have, then in 12 months, we'll give you 25%. And in 24 months, we'll give you the other 25%. So we got this award. At the time, Skookum had two licensed foster homes. So today we have 60, right? So two. We hadn't really done it before. Nobody starts these things. Like all of the people, all of the organizations who do foster parent training and support are big, old, established, like founded in 1880, founded in 1930, like really big, old, like behemoth organizations. Nobody starts them. The youngest one I know of was started in the mid 90s. So literally no one has started one in the last 20 years, 25 years. And, you know, we were just getting started, very, very small outfit, didn't really know the business. I mean, I had a sense for the business structure and like what the levers would be. And we had a theory of the case that like, if we do these things, then the result will be, you know, why. And we built our proposal for funding based on that. It was very aggressive. And we, you know, that was this particular funder had an appetite for aggression. They wanted, you know, big system change, you know, do something very different. They wanted to fund an experiment, which is right up my alley. And so the specific question they posed to us, what would it take to double the number of foster parents in your area, right? So for us, it's Whatcom County, in 3 years. So double the number in 3 years. And so we wrote a proposal for that, and that was what we got funded for. And So we got the first half free and clear. 12 months later, we hit our first round of targets. In the review meeting with the funder, I told them, so when they gave us the award originally, so we got the award letter, which is like all the terms, right? And it's very, you know, you could tell a lawyer had written it. It was, you know, you must, like, in order to get the second half of this funding, you must do X by date and Y by date, right? So it's very, like, technical and specific. And reply if you understand and agree, right? It's like that. And then, so I get the email, and immediately the funder calls me. And on the phone, very different tone. Like, we understand you're new. We understand you're, this is an experiment. We understand you're learning. And if the reality turns out to be different than you expect, we're going to be open to a conversation about that. That's what they said, which is exactly what you hope a funder would say, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I'm going to be flexible with you, right? And 12 months in, we have the review meeting. We hit our targets at month 12.
Not with lack of effort, from what I understand.
We nearly went bankrupt. It was touch and go. And at month 12, we had this review meeting, and I said, so we hit the targets. I cannot do it again. I cannot repeat what we just did in the last 12 months. I cannot do it again. We are going to miss the 24-month targets. What do you want me to do? Do you want to give us more money so that we hit those targets? Do you want to lower the targets? I think the exact question I posed was, do you want me to balance my budget or hit the targets? I cannot do both. And they said, you should balance your budget. And I took that to mean, I like remembered the phone call and gave them, and this is where, you know, the assume the best about people thing mm-hmm. bit me a little, because I assume like, oh, they like really believe in us and want us to be successful. They're going to fund us even if we're short, right? And so then we built our 2019 budget, assuming we were going to get funding and assuming we were going to be short of the targets. Because of course they know, of course we told them.
And what did they mean? Did they mean do both?
Do both is what they meant, yes.
Yeah, interesting.
And so in the 24-month review meeting, I just very casually said, yeah, no, you know, we had a good year, but we're a little short of the targets. And their eyes got real big. And they said, what? You're short? We're not going to fund you.
And so this was in September?
Yeah, so it was in July. So the check we were expecting was on August 1st, and it was equal to 15% of Skookum's budget. So we ran a campaign to make up half of that 150. The other half I felt like I could come up with by cutting costs. So I needed, you know, to come up with half of that by raising money and the other half by cutting costs. So we ran a campaign from, it was basically a month long that concluded here at the beginning of December to raise $65,000 in new revenue. And we finished the campaign at 105% of goal. So we hit the goal, felt good about that. December's been really strong. It's been amazing. Skookum is, I tell people all the time, I get entirely too much credit for what Skookum Kids has become. Skookum is this community deciding that it wanted to do foster care differently. It was Bellingham saying, we can do better. We can do better for kids in foster care. We can take better for them, take better care of them when they come into foster care, and we can do a better job supporting their foster parents. And when, you know, I was responsible for a major miscommunication with a funder, Bellingham rose up and said, we gotcha. We're gonna handle it. A nonprofit is owned by the community. And Skookum Kids can accomplish exactly as much good as the community decides to fund. It's a logical fallacy that I slip into sometimes, and that I think a lot of people slip into, is that, you know, Skookum belongs to Ray. Skookum is Ray's thing. That is not true. Skookum is Bellingham's thing, and I am a steward of it. I happen to be the keeper of it for now. But Skookum is the embodiment of Greater Bellingham saying, we can do better for kids in foster care.
And you recently were recognized as CEO of the Year from the Bellingham Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
And I think about that, and after you just explained that you're the steward of this organization, you're not necessarily the pinnacle of it. You're the steward of this. I wanted to bring that up, not to say, hey, let's high five and cheers to your success, mm-hmm. I wanted to recognize that, because there's something that I think a lot of people don't recognize about a leadership role. You're the representative of the company, but it's so much more. You're representing all of the people that you've seen the best in to hire, to bring on, that actually are the fuel for that to happen, right? And congratulations on that, by the way, to everyone at your organization, because and to Bellingham for making that happen too. Yeah. That's so important.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of getting to the end of this episode. It's been such an amazing time, you and I having a couple, two or three. And what do you see as the future for Skookum Kids? You've already taken it so far in this short amount of time, from this kind of part-time thing that you were doing to this full-time thing that you stepped into when the layoff happened, to where you are today, being a huge, huge part of foster care in Whatcom County and in Washington State. What's next?
You know, next for us is, in the nonprofit world, there's a phrase, a term. It's called the sustainability corner. Mm-hmm. And turning the sustainability, anytime you start something new, a charismatic founder, you know, kind of steps out, we're going to go do this thing, and kind of the work sort of rallies around an individual. And then there are certain things that only happen because of the individual's unique, you know, skills and personality. And then the sustainability corner is an organization has turned that corner when they can exist if the founder gets hit by a bus, right? And that doesn't mean the founder is going to leave, and that doesn't mean, you know, that the founder has gotten hit by a bus, but it means that if the founder did something different, moved on, that the organization could continue, right? It's about systems and documentation. It's about organizational maturity. It's about quality over quantity.
Creating leaders.
Yeah. And that's what's next at Skookum. What's next for Skookum is to stop being a startup and to start being a pillar of child welfare, forever part of the social safety net in Bellingham. So that is the sustainability corner, and I think that's what's next for us.
Ray, thank you so much for being here today and
thank
sharing
you.
Your wisdom.
This has been a lot of fun.
Cheers. Today marks our last show of 2019. We made it, everybody. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Building Bellingham and all of our amazing guests. For more information on how to get involved with Skookum Kids, you can visit www.skookumkids.org. You can find them on Instagram at Skookum Kids, or on Facebook. That's Skookum Kids, spelled SKOOKUM. For show notes and links, visit livebellinghamnow.com/blog. This episode was produced and edited by David Pender Lofgren. It was recorded and mixed by Andy Rick at Binary Studios. Our social media Jedi is Cooper Hansley. Our digital media producer is Tiffany Holden. Our theme music was written and performed by Aaron Guest. And our logo was designed by Sam Vogt. Building Bellingham is a proud member of the Bell Pod Network, a collective of independent podcasts made right here in the city of subdued excitement.